Okay, thanks, Victor. So, as Victor said, this is supposed to be a discussion session, and rather than a seminar, from last week I had a little problem distinguishing what was the difference between the two, but I'll try to make it more discussion-like, which means that you will have to work, and I can just sit there. So I wanted, for me, I mean, again, coming from the condensed matter side, I wanted to have a discussion on probes in cold atoms. And the reason for that is that, for me, I have sometimes the impression that cold atomic physics is reinventing a little bit something that was a big joke in computer science, which was the write-only memory. A memory where you can write, but you can never get information back. And we all heard about that we can realize, you know, three-dimensional Hubbard model, one-dimensional Hubbard model, 3, 2, 0, whatever. The question is, how does one measures what one has? And that's the thing which, for me, is not completely clear. And I would like to list with you the probes I know, and maybe you can add the probe you know, and we can see whether some quantities can be measured, or whether I guess I lose my recording here. So let's see if I can put this back. Okay. So let's see what exists. So I think, for the given the audience, it's fairly clear that I would say, if one is interested in something which is strong correlations in cold atomic physics, then the use of wave function is usually very delicate. The use of eigenstates is usually not very fruitful. And what one wants to get are usually correlation functions. So something which I would say condensed matter physicists have, of course, dealt with in a very long time, is that most of the observable you measure is some correlation function of some kind, which is the average over a quantum state, or the thermal average if you're at finite temperature, of two operators or one operator at two different points and two different time. And the fact that you're able to measure this at two different points and at two different times is something which is crucial. And this is really the type of quantities we would like to get in cold atomic physics. And this is the thing which, for me, I would like to discuss with you a little bit more, what is possible and what is not possible. The other thing which is important, usually in dealing with standard phenomena of strongly correlated system in condensed matter, is that one has to deal with long distance, large time, and usually homogeneous systems, which means that when you have your blob of matter here, whether you measure the correlation function here or there or there is usually not very important. And this is also something we have to discuss when it's cold atoms, because, of course, there is the Bloch confining potential, which makes the life of theorists quite complicated, and this will have some impact on the probes that that can be used. So that's essentially the...
By Faber chain and time also, you know, the initial conditions are often very important.
Yeah.
It might not be a function.
Yeah. So let me add here, so there is the confining potential, and there is the initial condition. Okay. And again, this is a discussion session, so don't hesitate to modify the flow of what I'm saying here. So I will give you the probe I know, and then, okay, I will more insist on two probes that we specially studied, and you will see which one they are. One exists and the other does not exist yet. So we'll see. So the first probe, which everybody uses is the time of flight measurement, and I won't detail what it is, but essentially you all know that this is releasing the trap and measuring essentially the density profile once the trap has been released. And if I translate this into a correlation function, which is what I will try to do, what it measures is the single particle correlation function, which is essentially the equal time single particle correlation function of the creation of a particle at a given point, the destruction of a particle at a given point. And this is something which has been fantastically useful for bosons. Why? Because if you look at this object, this is what is the trace of off-diagonal long-range order. So if you have a superfluid, this object has essentially, if you do the Fourier transform, a delta function peak at kq equals zero, while if you have, let's say, a Mott insulator where the density is uniform, you get something which is essentially a smooth function and which has no peak. So for bosons, by looking at this quantity, you get a lot of information on the nature of the physics in the system.
Time of flight, I think they measure this in Fourier space. They measure that directly with the pictures.
No, but essentially you can reconstruct out of this, you can reconstruct essentially this correlation function. So this is the Fourier.
What they actually observe.
This is the n of k, which is the Fourier transform. Absolutely. Which is the n of k, so I should put k here, and I should put k here. I'm just saying that n of k is just the Fourier transform of this quantity.
Except to the extent that you don't observe that. That's what you're doing.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, there's clearly interaction in this finite size effects, and this is all incidentally relying on, you know, to some degree, this time of flight method, which showed everything so quickly and smoothly for the weakly interacting constants, may all probes have to be very delicately reinterpreted when you're dealing with strongly interacting systems.
But there are two levels, and I'm not sure I understand which level you object to. One is the fact that the probe measures essentially this correlation function, which can be incredibly complicated, of course, in a strongly correlated system.
But the assumption you're making in this probe is that at time zero, when it turns off the potential and turns off all interactions,
yes,
and allows the system to expand,
yes,
from there ballistically,
yes,
and measures with infinite spatial resolution.
Yeah.
So none of those are real.
Yes. Okay, so that's the second step you object. You object that the experiment is in fact giving you access to n of k. So that's well taken point. I would say most people would have assumed this or used this.
For example, in the VEC experiments, one never saw a delta function.
No, but one sees a peak, let's say. Yeah. Finite system, you should not expect to see a real delta function.
The time of flight was always an energetic difference between the condensate and the non-condensed atoms, never the coherence difference. Even though this is specifically a statement about coherence.
Can I make some comments? I think there will be, in fact, a lot of discussions in the comments on this. I think that there are several cases that are difficult to distinguish. One is that whether one is dealing with a large trap, the other one is whether one is dealing with a peak lattice. In the case of large traps, which is really known very well, that the, for example, the Thomas Fermi already tells you that all the energy is in the not that energy. So therefore, the expansion in large traps is really driven by directions that are happening by dynamics. Now, the question is that whether the peak lattice, when the 1A6 is so narrow, whether energy content, the 1A6 is so much higher than n times u, with 2 atoms on the outside, then in that case one can just estimate what the energy is. It's just a huge difference. Now, then the question is when I'm doing an expansion in that limit, then where does the interaction energy go? Whether it will go in the width or whether it will go on the background. Let me just assume that if I use the point of data, whether super good or whatever order is highly depleted, that means that the interaction is very strong in the background. then therefore the background will take up a lot of the expansion. It's not that interaction. In the case of sharp or deep lattices, it goes to the width, it will affect the background a lot. So, I'm just saying that there's a huge difference between the expansion in a deep lattice and then the interaction in large structures.
But again, the deep lattice is removed when you make the expansion normally.
At the moment, there's a big debate between me and Emmanuel Bloch. He's up at the moment. He is saying that, look, I mean, the ballistic expansion, which every single paper uses, is now may not be that good now. So therefore, what exactly? How we interpret the N of K is different. And then he has a way to deal with it, which we disagree completely. But how to interpret the interaction data at the moment, the Emmanuel Bloch group completely reverse what they think.
Okay, so let me maybe sort of summarize it in a question mark, which is that if I understand well from what comes out of it, even the time of flight measurement doesn't seem to be so, let's say, under control, in the sense that it's not obvious in all situations, and you would say probably that for not too strong interaction it works, maybe not too anisotropic geometries or something like this, but that it's not obvious that the time of flight measurement gives the N of K. Do I interpret correctly what you said? And again, what is N of K in a strongly interacting system can be in itself an extremely complicated question. But that's a different issue. I don't care if I have the 2D Hubbard model, I don't know what is this object here because I'm unable to compute it. But the question is whether using this probe, it is this object that is measured.
Always keep in mind that depending whether there's an optical lattice or not, and how one turns off the optical lattice at which speed, which it depends which N of K one measures, whether it's the N of K of the full wave functions or it's the N of K of the Vanier wave functions. That actually there is also this adapticity by turning off the optical lattice, with which speed one does it, which determines the result which one sees.
The current method is all by all its members is to turn it off as fast as possible, although it's not infinite, as fast as possible. All those may be shorter than 3 seconds. The question at the moment is that whether in deep lattices it is ballistic or not. Maybe
that's one question. No, I mean, Johannes Degenschlag varies the speed by switching it off. So if they do it quickly,
slowly,
they see the coherence peak of the reciprocal lattice vectors. If they do this slowly, they map out the real zone.
Now you have to do it probably quick compared to the time for the particle to move inside the system. Otherwise, your system has a long time to rearrange before you measure anything. So that is okay. I mean, you know. No, the question is whether there is at least a limit which is controlled experimentally in which, so there is probably only one experimentalist in the room, so all the eyes converge to you. But I'm joking. This seems to be a debate. This is what you're saying, if I take
it has not been a debate until very recently.
Okay.
All its mentalists, if you look at all the papers.
Yeah, that's what I would have said.
It was raised for different reasons. May not be appropriate to get into it now. But there's a real, very clear physics reason, which is that what is the role interaction play in this expansion? We are not talking about what makes it complicated N of K. It's just that suppose you make them, then when you turn it off rapidly, as even you turn it off infinitely rapidly, then what is the effect of interaction subsequently?
But as a practitioner, in principle, one could tell the poor experimentalist to use a Fischbach resonance and set interactions to zero exactly at this point.
No, you can get a
specific velocity.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, but let me move. Okay, so it's good that at least, you see, for me, I would have probably ticked this mark without second thoughts, but okay, it's good to see that they are second thoughts. But I have very strong, or I have problems with, of course, this time of flight measurement for fermions, because in that case, if you measure the n of k, what you get is essentially a Fermi step function, and then the information you can extract out of it is extremely limited, because if you have a Mott insulator, you will open a gap and you will replace this by something like this. If you have a superfluid, you will open a gap and you will replace this by something like this. And if you are at finite temperature, or if you have a confining trap, you will replace this by something like this. So I'm not so sure that for fermions there is something really serious to salvage from the N of K. But again, that's okay, no objection. So I guess. So I would say the advantage of the method is that for bosons, let's say it's easy. I shouldn't say this, people will kill me, but that's okay. It has problems for fermions, that's for sure. And okay, there are a lot of questions that we heard about the on the availability of this. There is an extension of this method, which is the noise. And this is the method that Heywood, Altman, Eugene Demmler, and Lukin sort of pioneered, which is to use the fact that you can average over several images to extract the noise. So instead of measuring, let's say, the average of the density, what you measure is the density-density correlation, so the noise in the image you get. And out of this noise, what you can extract are correlation functions. Again, I want your feedback on that. My impression is, okay, so this is a very efficient method. It measures some four-point correlation functions, and this is at different points. Let me note it loosely like this. And this is, again, equal time. So all these objects are essentially at the same time in the system. So it still doesn't give access to the dynamics of the system. So I would put in the advantage of this method that it allows you to get correlation function, and it's especially good if you want to see ordered state. So this has been advocated, for example, as a method to detect antiferromagnetism, because of course the noise will depend on what is the periodicity in your system.
So even if it's like Mott insulators, there's a signature of them.
You have a signature in the noise. You have a signature if it's a superfluid. So depending on the phase in the system, normally this correlation function is of course different, just like the N of K is different depending on whether you're in the Mott insulator and the superfluid. I would say for most quantities, it's more of course complicated to compute this function. So if I had to put a slight disadvantage to this method, is that usually the calculation of this function is not something which is trivial.
But what I mean is that, I mean, you wrote ordered states, I mean, it allows you to access disordered states as well.
What I mean is that if you have something which has, for example, a doubling of the unit cell, like with an antiferromagnetic structure, it's something that is supposed to have a good signature in the noise. So I agree with you. You can also compute from the state, you can go back to the noise. Let's say it's very simple if the system has an order parameter. You see it directly as a periodic structure in the noise. Here you really need to do a calculation and see, then compare whatever decays.
But I guess what I was going to say is, I mean, if it actually has an order parameter, then you can probably extract it from the first thing, from the average n.
Not really. Not really. For example, if you have antiferromagnetism, then if you have, let's say, imagine you have realized fermions with spins. Mm-hmm. Okay, the holy grail being, let's say, the 2D Hubbard model, which I don't think is necessarily the most interesting thing, but which is certainly something exciting. So you have your Hubbard model and you want to know whether it's antiferromagnetic. Mm-hmm. Fine. And then, I don't even know how to draw an antiferromagnetic pattern anymore, but okay. And you have this. Then you will release, you're sensitive to the density, so you don't see the isospin of the system. So you're absolutely unable here to decide whether the system has developed an antiferromagnetic or the parameter. Mm-hmm. So if it's an internal degree of freedom, you will not see it.
Is that true? I thought sometimes you could image different spin states separately.
Again, that's a discussion, so I'm getting for your feedback.
Different spin states separately. And you would see that there's peaks that shouldn't.
So this is feasible, because my impression was that let's say, time scale of a couple of years ago, this was not feasible. I mean, this was not done, at least.
But that's what when you're after, you're wanting to see whether there's this pattern in there.
Yeah, for example. Yeah.
But not at one single level. Each one of these is unlabeled.
Yeah, you want to know whether you get the pattern like this.
I mean, you can't.
Oh, in principle, if it's in the lattice, just transfer all spin states, which just been up into the same hot lattice, that in time of flight, if it is periodic, it will double the Brillouin zone.
If you can separate the two, spatially the two lattices. No, I agree. I'm just saying if you do a simple time of flight experiment, you release, normally you don't see. So one has to find another procedure.
Quite easily. You would do time of flight. Mm-hmm. You would just separate or image the spin separately.
Okay, so what you're saying is that one way to observe antiferromagnetism would be essentially to separate spatially the spin up and the spin down, and then image them separately. So this has been done, or not? Or what are the problems? Well,
it would be straightforward.
Okay. Okay.
You signed it.
Okay. You signed. No, because then if this is straightforward, this would be an interesting measurement to do.
No, but let's make the point. State selected imaging is no problem.
Okay. So then one needs to realize, let's say, a lattice of fermions and see whether there is or there is not antiferromagnetism in this system.
Right. No, I still don't see how this would come out with NFK, but even if it was selected.
NFK is a particular species. So suppose I measure N psi up, R1 up, and then DAB.
But then you still
have R4 up and R2 up, are down for time.
But I agree, you still have, you would see, yeah, I agree. I agree, you would still have something which is a step function with half the number of particles. So how do you know it's ordered?
You talk about fermions, so you have to go back to your noise interferometry.
Yeah, so you have to.
Yeah.
So you have still to do a noise measurement.
Yeah,
okay, so separating or doing this will not help you. You still have to do the noise measurement in this thing, because just measuring the average NFK is not enough. So if we put the noise here, I don't know. So the advantage is that it's good for ordered states. Problems, I don't know if there are problems. It's not easy to compute. Are there any questions I should list? Yep.
I'm really confused about something which is very basic. So if you have a boson similaris and then the insulating regime, which means let's say one boson per site, all you see is just some small function of K, nothing special.
Yeah.
But if you have, let's say, fermions on the lattice and you release fermions, are you supposed to see the same thing?
No.
You'll see peaks at
no. What do you mean? For the average N of K?
I'm talking about the picture on.
Okay, so this one will give you essentially the Fermi factor.
Uh-huh.
And now, if you think about what the Mott insulator or whatever insulator does, when you open a gap, if you look at the N of K, you just broaden the N of K by something which is the size of the gap here. So you go from a perfect step function, which is the Fermi liquid or the free electron or whatever. So if it's a Fermi liquid, it will have the discontinuity, into something which is broadened by a gap. So So it's extremely difficult to see. It's not as marked a difference here between a peak at Q equals zero and absence of peak at Q equals zero. It's something which is a smooth step function instead of being a sharp step function. And of course, if you had infinite resolution, you would see how it's broadened, and you would even be able to fit to a model deciding whether it's broadened because it has become superconducting or whether it's because Mott insulator. But in practice,
but your example with the fermi headquarter. So suppose I get an image independently spins up and spins down. What do I expect to see?
If you image, I would say you would see two-step function, no? Or am I wrong when I say that?
Well, how will I know that? Would you be able to determine that this is antiferromagnetic order?
I don't think so. My gut feeling is no. I would have to think and give you an answer, but my gut feeling is that if you measure the average n of k, even if you separate specially the two things, you will not see it. You need to make, again, some noise, some correlation function.
No, but I think it's single shot measured. If you don't average over the phase, you will measure the peaks. You will measure the peaks.
Which peak? There is no peak. If it's fermion, you see a step.
I think, in general, you can't see something which is an order parameter in a two-body correlation function and a one-body correlation function. So the reason you can see it both compensate in this thing is because it's off diagonal.
Yeah, top diagonal long-range order. So the order parameter here is the average of time.
No, but what I mean is, if you can measure the single spin component, you would see that there's the period is double.
No, but you measure the average of the density as a function of distance between two points. So you would see that you get just a doubling of the period in the sense that Kf has been changed. But so what? It doesn't tell you if it's ordered or not ordered.
I thought we were talking about measuring the noise of the
pulse. No. I think the question of Leo is whether one can do it with a single, without doing the noise. And my impression is no.
Not doing an average from, not doing an average over many measurements, just do single shot.
No.
I mean, if it would be bosons which are coherent, you would immediately see that issue.
Yeah, but we are talking about fermions here.
Fermions, yeah. It will be more sharp.
But you're saying the Kf will change. Can I use that to determine that there is an antiferromagnetic order?
Probably not, because you've just split the number of particle in two.
If there was a basic state or something, and would also probably get two.
Okay, so let me put that as a question. Let me put that as a question, but my impression is that the answer to this question is no. So, yeah.
Just as a short comment, I mean, measuring n of k in an interacting Fermi system, I mean, maybe at the moment it's a question of not having enough resolution, but I mean, presumably 10 years ago, if someone had talked about a MIG-DAG discontinuity, you just said that's just something in theory. And if there's really a prospect of actually measuring it and seeing it shrink as you turn up the interactions, then that will be very exciting. So.
No, I agree that, for example, in condensed matter theory, this is something that came with essentially progress in photoemission. Measuring n of k is highly non-trivial task. And that's why I think it's especially interesting to know whether there is something that can give it in the cold atom business. And okay, that's why I guess we are discussing to know what are the probes and what one can do and what cannot do.
So I mean, maybe the thing is that n of k is most interesting when you're in the Fermi liquid, where there is a discontinuity, and then the question is how big it is.
No, I agree. I totally agree with you. And that's the thing I was going to the other probes I know, which is that I think one limitation of these objects is that they give essentially access to static quantities. And most often what one is interested in when there are strong interactions, and as you said, in the Fermi liquid, one has, strictly speaking, the discontinuity here to worry about, which again, in an inhomogeneous system, is probably not that important. But what one would like is the time dependence of this object, because this is what gives the energy dependence. And all these probes will not give you very interesting information as long as you don't go to the energy dependence, which is what the photoemission does in condensed matter. So. Shout, Leo, shout. This is a discussion session.
Well, I'm still not clear. So if you play fermions in the, just the, in the trap, in the large trap, and I, let's say, principle, I measure this, I'll measure the N of K, right?
Yeah.
Is there, are there features? What are the features? What are the different features if I now have it in the labs and I measure N of K? So is there, you're saying there's going to be the same?
I think it's essentially the same thing, depending on what the lattice does to your system. If it transforms the system in a Mott insulator, for example.
Let's say it's still,
is it a Fermi liquid? Yeah. Well, it's side binding description of a Fermi liquid. It's still essentially the same N of K. And again, I would say for me, but again, maybe there are other opinion, in the cold atomic system, if you look at something which is supposed to be characterized by a sharp discontinuity, then all these elements of confining potential, inhomogeneities, and things like this start playing a crucial role, and you will never see, these are things that people can worry into a very homogeneous system. But so far, if you have a finite size system and highly inhomogeneous, in any case it will broaden the thing. So, it's another story.
So yeah. This noise measurement can basically include a compressibility?
That's a good question, yeah. Potentially they include the compressibility because it's a four-body correlation function. In practice it's a relatively twisted correlation function. I mean, it's not the nice correlation function you would like for the compressibility. It's not the density in the standard sense. Compressibility is essentially the zero frequency and then Q going to zero limit of the density correlation function. While again, these guys are equal time correlation function. So they are not giving you the zero frequency. So it's not exactly the compressibility. It's some complicated correlation function. So are there other comments on these probes? Okay, so let me add another probe, which I think is interesting, and which starts giving access to, in principle,
yeah. To answer your question, whether you can tell the anti-bone method, the noise can do that.
Yeah, noise can do that. No, I think it's one of the very interesting question of the noise.
Yeah, the question is whether there are more things you can look into in this in the end of K than it's just different matter.
Yeah. I want to put maybe here on this list, and again, people might agree or disagree, something we heard from Tillman last week, which I would say is somehow solving in part the problem of the inhomogeneities, which is this way to do RF knives and cutting slices of the system and then measuring the correlation function of these two slices. This is a way to get the correlation between two objects which are at point R1 and R2. As far as I understand it, it's still equal time correlation function. The advantage I see with this method is that at least he can control exactly where in the system he can make the slice, which means that he can choose a part of the system which is far enough from the edge or which is not too contaminated by the end of the confining potential. So it probably improves over the standard technique of time of flight. I don't know if you have comments on this one or... Yeah?
There is this question about this zero momentum,
yeah.
And so on.
Yeah. So I don't know how we would call it. Selected. I'll comment on this comment, or maybe you want to do it again while I write. Okay. So the comment is the following, which is that if you look at how it's done, essentially, it's done by sending RF on the system, and then depending on the energy, which is determined by the gravity, the thing is extracting a slice and then another slice of the system, which means that normally what you would say is that you integrate over all the atoms at the given plane here for a given z. And so normally what you measure is this, but for qx, qy equals 0, qx, qy equals 0. and this is as a function of z2 and z1. Except that this is far from being converged, in the sense that there is a big debate on whether this is what is measured or whether something else is measured in this experiment. So I would say here for this experiment, the question on what exactly is measured.
I have a basic question also about what is measured. Is it clear that you measure psi psi dagger this way? So you kick out two particles, right?
You know this joke, I think it was Hardy. Someone, he was giving a course and one of his students asked him, is it obvious? He was writing mathematical equations and saying, it's obvious that. And one of the students said, is it obvious? And so he thinks and starts writing for 15 minutes on the board and then turns to the guy and said, yeah, yes, it's obvious. So no, it's not obvious that it's this which is measured. And I'm not sure I fully understand why it's this which is measured, but my understanding is that it's a complicated process because you extract, you convert things out of the trap, then they go, they interfere in the detector.
But you kick out two things, and that is what worries me. A single particle collision, or single particle function, it is something that you kick out one particle and you.
You kick out the objects at two different points in the system. So it's like when you make interferences between the two condensates.
But if you have psi dagger on psi, you don't have any interference. If you have the same condensate, they always have the same phases, hence.
Yeah, so and this is.
If you want to have an interference pattern, that's the question. It must be psi dagger, psi dagger.
I don't think so, but I don't want to. I'm not enough familiar with this. I think it's the same. That's a good. I think this is exactly the same measurement than this one. But okay, let me not put my head on the. But you wanted to comment on that.
He was assuming that he would measure. That he was tracking the phone.
You would like that instead of that? I don't think will work. I think this is what is measured, but
it's very simple. Experimentally, they just take a photograph,
yes.
And then I'm measuring at psi of r and t, and so I'm at that particular point. Now the question, where does it come from? Then I have to do pocketing backward at time and the previous time, one of them come from here and there, and the reason they come from different places because of the different gravitational potentials. So what is really measured is in fact this thing at that particular time, but then if you want to relate this back to the original ones, then you have to work it backward in time. Now the backward time in this particular measurement, in his measurement, there's no interaction. In fact, there's no interaction. In fact, why? Because the whole thing tunnel out. When it tunnel out, then they
No, then the thing is out of the trap. There is no interaction. No, the fact that there is a time back that you have to work out.
It is outside depth that they were measuring.
So that's what I wrote. But the point I want to make is, there might be, if you have an initial condition, a question of time to reach the detector or whatever. If you are in a, let's say, equilibrium state, the only thing that matters is that these two objects are at the same time. And then you also don't have access to dynamics of the system. Okay? So I would say, I would put it in the same, so the advantage is that it avoids problems, I think, with confining potential. But if you want to do spectroscopy, meaning have access to time dependence, at least for me, I don't know that many probes. I know the RF spectroscopy. That we heard last week. And which was in a paper by Torma and Soler, for example. And again, what this is doing is doing a resonant Raman scattering, off resonance Raman scattering, and extracting objects from the trap. And so essentially what this is measuring is, the spectral function. So it's the probability of having a particle with momentum k and frequency omega, and because you're doing it homogeneously, then you sum over. So you measure the flow of particle away from the trap, so you get something which is some object like this that I would not detail. So this is like, if you want, for people in condensed matter, this is like essentially a planar junction. So you're essentially doing a tunneling experiment with measuring spectral density of state, and you integrate over all this spectral density of state. So I would say this is one experiment that certainly does give access to the spectral function here. The point is that you make the integral over k, and you make the integral over the momentum, or you conserve the momentum depending on how you view it. So you don't get, I would say, much. Okay, so you can get only energetic information, and this was used, for example, to decide whether you would get a gap in a superconductor or whether you don't get a gap in a superconductor. There is a modification of this which was proposed recently by Antoine Georges, Dalibard, and collaborator, which is simply to do this RF spectroscopy, but not with one laser, but with two lasers with different momenta, and therefore you can get some resolution in momentum too. So this is what I would call RF spectroscopies, plural. And so the advantage is that you get some level of access to the spectral function, but with complicated sums in front of it. I don't know if there are comments on this probe, or if people want to add something. No?
I wasn't aware of the phantom.
Let me say it that way. It's a probe that does not exist anymore. This one exists, the RF spectroscopy. The extension is a theoretical proposal.
To measure KE or K omega, I can use the practical principle of practical spectroscopy, which is you have two lasers with K1, K2, and then you can control the directions, you can control the Q and also the energy difference, and then that has been done by Kepler's group measuring the Bob-Newton particles.
Yeah, I guess what they wanted to do is to do it for fermions.
Well, that's really a density correlation function, but is this a spectral function?
This is supposed to be the spectral function.
Bragg spectroscopy, exactly. Which is the density correlation.
This is not Bragg spectroscopy, this is Raman.
I mean, here, if one compares what Houdini was doing, there are essentially three possibilities. So one has the two hyperfine states which make the effective spin up, spin down.
Mm-hmm.
So one can, with radio frequency, convert one spin up particle to a third hyperfine state, which is what you hold down.
Mm-hmm.
Another method would be to actually convert one
species into another species.
Which would be spin structure factor.
Yeah. So I think one extension of this would be to measure essentially objects like this. I don't know if it has been done. I don't think so far. I've seen theoretical proposals on that, but I've not seen experimental papers measuring this type of object. I don't know if you... No answer. So I guess for the moment it stays in the realm of theoretical proposals.
I guess I put these on two different rows because one is like up there, one is like neutron. So.
Yeah, I buy it. It's still... So you want to call it Raman, and then measurement of the S correlation function, and here I guess the question is whether it exists, whether someone has actually done it. And I agree, the closest to this is Raman, is neutrons. For me, the closest to this is the planar junction in condensed matter, although it's not exactly the same. Time of flight has no real equivalence, although you would like to put it in the realm of photoemission. And to some extent, the extension of this one, you would like also to put a little bit like photoemission system.
I think you would argue that Bragg and Raman scattering are a form of photo emission.
I think the main point is, again, one way to measure directly this, and I agree that this is one way to do it. Again, as I said, I searched recently for papers doing this, but I could not find any. So if you know some, I would be interested to know. And take potentially by Raman, this is possible. And then to measure things which give you time-dependent correlations, and then this one is one of these functions giving you access to the frequency. Okay. Then there is another one that I want to discuss in more detail. Simply, we worked on it, and also because I think it's an interesting probe, which is the shaking of the optical lattices, which was something that the group of Tillmann, Esslinger did, and I think this is also something that gives some information on the dynamics of the system. So I don't know if you have, before I move to the shaking, there are other probes you would like to add on this list. It's not that much, huh? If you compare with everything one can do with charged particle in condensed matter. But it's okay. One has the neutrons, one has the photo emission, so it's not that far.
But I think it's a little bit unfair because,
of course,
you know, it's like saying in condensed matter all you measure is a current through some in some detector or something. That, you know, there's a lot of, you know, these experiments are pretty imaginative, but in the end they measure time applied density profiles. But what they do to your cloud before they release it is really the
don't get me wrong. I mean, this is fantastic systems. This is fantastic system and this is fantastic experiments. And I'm not and again the system opens, you know, absolutely fantastic potentiality, especially for out of equilibrium phenomena, for measuring time dependent objects and whatever. Here I'm just trying to sort of make a list on exactly by how many angle one can attack a problem. And I agree that you can already, you know, simply with the time of flight and pending the problem of whether one measures N of K or not, access things like the dynamics of the going from a Mott insulator to a superfluid, which, you know, in condensed matter, one would only dream about.
So what I mean is, like, even if you know, not worry about the dynamics, I mean, that's really exciting and not as good, but like the way they measure, you know, superfluid order on the BCS side in these special back resonant systems by projecting onto the...
Yeah, so I should have...
Case. In the end, you still measure this density profile, but it's what you've done to the system before.
So I should have add here the formation of molecules. Essentially, which is, I think, a probe that does not exist at all, except for people doing numerical simulations, for example, in condensed matter, which is measuring the number of doubly occupied sites.
Right. So, for example, you know, if you just don't discuss that aspect of it, then you say, okay, all you can measure is that one of those smoothed out Fermi distributions.
Yeah.
But in fact, you measure one of those and real ELFA. It's a big question of how the two are related, but when you measure it, actually...
No, but that's why I'm asking in general whether one should add probes to this list. You know, what I would like to have at the end of this discussion, okay, besides telling you a little bit more on the shaking of the optical lattice, which I think is interesting in itself, and another probe, which is the analog of the STM that we propose for...
So Leo has a good defense for the...
No. I would like to know whether one should add.
That was only 10 years,
okay. Yeah. No, but again, it's not a match. You know, it's not a fight of condensed matter versus cold atoms. Quite the contrary. It's just to know whether one should add elements to this list, because if a probe exists, there is no point in trying to invent a new one. And if a probe does not exist, then it's worth thinking, you know, rather to imagine how to do the whatever hypercubic five-dimensional lattice on the thing. It might be worth thinking on how to measure things that we know are important to measure in connection with simple model. I'll try to keep it at not too unreasonable time for the discussion session. So anything between 5 and 6 hours is okay. Okay, so are there other things I should add to this?
So is there something like Bragg spectroscopy?
There is Bragg spectroscopy. Again, some people probably know more than I do about this. Where would you put it, and what would you say has been measured with it?
It seems like you're including it in the RF spectroscopy.
Yeah, I think it's already included in the RF.
Change of internal state.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it really more comes with the RAM one because it's more like measuring row instead of SS.
So measuring SS, that's a product of four.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean that's my superficial distinction for this one.
So you would put more. You would more put it here.
Yeah.
I would probably agree.
Well, but a bit is missing is tools like inducing vortices for measuring superfluidity or measuring or elongating the thread and letting oscillate for measuring.
So I think I didn't put the vortices not because I don't like them, but because I sort of had in mind fermionic problems in connection with strong correlations. And I agree, measuring superfluidity or measuring superconductivity by just seeing whether one has vortices is certainly a way, and a way which has been used a lot. So I should add it here in this list. So let's say if one wants to see whether as a superconductor, you would say you measure the vortices. And then there was something you said which I didn't put on the list but which is also interesting, which is there something like measuring a current? And here I think it's quite okay. When I discuss the shaking, it's some form of measuring a current, but we'll come back to that. But one way is the way you were saying, that you get a system which you shift and then you try to see how it oscillates in the... This is also a very imperfect, quote, way of doing it, and it would be... I think this is an example where it would be fantastic to have something better.
But what is the difference now to shaking of the lattice?
I'll come back. No, here you don't shake the lattice. I'll explain what the shaking of the lattice is. Here you just have the lattice, you have the confining potential, you shift laterally the confining potential, so you force your condensate to move through the lattice. And the idea is that if it moves, it's a metal or a superfluid. If it doesn't move, it's an insulator.
So the lattice is fixed and you move the
trap? And you move the trap. Okay. Shaking the lattice, I'll come to it in a moment, is not that. You have a lattice of a certain amplitude, and what you do, you just increase and decrease the amplitude of the lattice. So if the particles are at a given point, they are not moving. But you will see that it still allows to extract some information out of it.
And I guess the other big one is dispersive imaging.
What is dispersive imaging? I should confess.
A lot of these have an in situ capability also. So, for example, in teleflight, you seem to be focusing on the density distribution, not the momentum distribution. But one could also measure the density distribution, and indeed one could measure any angle in phase space between position and momentum.
Okay.
So similarly with the spin-spin, that's what we do all the time. We measure spin-spin correlation functions directly.
So this is a time-of-flight experiment, but instead of just measuring essentially uniform...
Position, I don't know, is the position distribution a time-of-flight measurement? I'm not sure, but...
So again, what is measured? Okay, I'm totally ignorant of this one. So what is measured?
Well, I'm not really sure what is measured. Anyhow, so with dispersive imaging, you take pictures in situ, right?
Okay.
So you can measure densities.
Oh, so you don't release the trap. This is what you mean. You just take the pictures in situ.
Fine. You can measure densities. You can measure spin and other variants of coherence between different cloud states.
But I think typically the cloud is too small to cut an image.
Use a lens.
This is something you can do. I have good eyes, you know. So. I have good eyes.
For example, you want to see the momentum.
But this is something you can do with an optical lattice?
Yeah, the manual clock has recently taken a very beautiful measurement on the
in situ.
On the new space density. Now, the difference, when you talk about Tillman, the reason that it's not done is that it's just very difficult.
What's the difficulty?
It's a tremendous difficulty. That part of difficulty, I do not know. But then it is a needle eye and mirror eye and mirrors or whatnot. And he can talk, but his dispersed imaging is very powerful, but it's only it's really done. And in fact, Tillman was talking whether he should invest time and money to develop that technique. I just want him to do so because I don't, after 9 months, you have something that you can use all the time. And he's saying about series about 50, but it's just it's hard that we can do. Just if we look at the manual box releasing data, it's very beautiful data. You can see the steps and without looking at that.
So are there? Yeah.
So what kind of spatial resolution can you get with dispersive imaging, and do you image on a particular plane in 3D or?
So this is, you know, this is certainly this is a developing capability. So in dispersive imaging, so this is optical imaging. So the trivial thing is to get to a resolution which is a few times the optical wavelength. Hmm. If you're forming a lattice using scanning waves where the atoms are separated by half a wavelength and it's the same wavelength, then yeah, then it becomes harder. You need some pretty fancy techniques to get around it. So if that's your intention to see at the single lattice site level, then you have a little bit of a tough road to hoe. But it's one that people have actually hoed. So there's very nice work coming out of Penn State where they image single atoms one by one in a lattice site. And they have three-dimensional capabilities. They can see every single atom, every row,
okay,
and
plane. Thermal, is it thermal?
That one has to be thermal, but you can imagine, you know, you want to see this pattern directly. You just do it. This anti-ferromagnetic pattern.
Yeah, we have a...
Use it in place and take a picture of it. In situ, you can also measure... So you can also measure, the coherence, kind of like what Tillman is doing, but you can do it directly rather than spilling atoms out of the trap. So you can see spatially homogeneous properties.
But Penn State still had increased the lattice spacing.
Right, the way they did it was they stretched out the lattice image. Presumably you could recompress it to do the physics.
And Markus Greiner is building that control, well, he really has wavelength preservation.
Right, that's what I'm saying, it's developing. You people are going to get
okay.
It.
Okay, so you say something that one has to keep an eye on. Okay. Are there other probes I should...
Theorists usually consider some flux insertion into the torus and the electronic system in two-dimensional system, for example. And might be the optical lattice you can cook up some torus.
I don't know. I mean, for the moment, it's always more or less quadratic confinement. So how to make a torus out of it? I send back the question to you.
There's a torus, so you should.
Yes, you can make ring traps.
So you can insert some flux inside the torus.
Flux,
you have to rotate because it's not charged, so you cannot just put
the. You want a flux in this ring direction or in this.
So basically, you can construct some tube, right? And having some shape. So this is a two-dimensional system.
Yeah, but you want the flux to be in this direction or some of the torus like this.
I just cut this direction and make some tube. And so it's like a cylinder, and then you can rotate in this direction. Then you can.
Oh, I see. You want the flux along. Okay, this is a little bit.
Yeah, this is what people do, for example, to measure persistent current in condensed matter. But I guess here. No, that's not what he wanted to do.
He wanted the flux go through the
ring.
Inside,
right? Not perpendicular to the ring. Okay, that's fine.
Did something interesting. What is it for?
I just ask. Measuring the compressivity, you usually set a flux to find
So maybe I can. Are there other probes that we should add to this list or not? No. Okay, so maybe I can tell you in maybe 10 minutes or 15 minutes about one probe I didn't mention here, which I think is a fairly simple and interesting probe that has been used by essentially the group of Tillman, and in particular, which is the shaking of a lattice. And the idea is, and there was a big debate on this, which is I'll show you. I'll use a little bit of the screen here. But essentially, what is the idea? So you have the system in an optical lattice, And then what you do, you just change the amplitude of this optical lattice with a signal which is modulated in time. So instead of having something which is V0 cosine QX, you just replace it by V0 plus delta V cosine omega T times cosine QX. So essentially, you just make the lattice bigger, smaller, bigger, smaller, bigger, smaller. And essentially, you measure the energy that is absorbed. And so for bosons, what you do, you just release the trap and then measure essentially the distribution after you have released the trap. So essentially, you shake your lattice like this, and you measure the energy. And I will show you what is seen and how it was interpreted. And there was a really big debate on...
you should probably see if it's... after you release, you measure kinetic energy?
Yeah, you measure the energy. You measure the energy, essentially, that has been absorbed in the system. So by measuring the N of K, by measuring N of K, which is why you don't do it for fermions, essentially. Oh, yes, thank you. No, I think it works. Yeah. So here is what is measured. And this is one of the image which is in the paper from the group of Tillman. And also let me comment a little bit. So this is the full width at half maximum. So this is a measure of the absorbed energy. This is the frequency of the modulation of the lattice. So this is the frequency at which you modulate the height of the lattice with time. And essentially this is the strength of the, let's say, in local repulsion in the system. And you see that there is a change in behavior between, and here the system is in the 1D limit. So they have an optical lattice which makes the system made of tubes. So this is really high tubes enough so that you can consider that this is a bunch of 1D systems. And you see that depending on the strength of the local repulsion, there is a broad absorption here. And then there is a regime where you see peaks which are relatively well formed. And what was said in the paper at that time, which is very reasonable, is that this phase here is the Mott insulator. They have about one boson per side. This is for bosons, I insist. And here, this would be the super. And there was no sort of detailed argument why it should be that way, but the idea is that in an insulator you get discrete energies and so on and so forth. And there was a sort of big debate on why you should measure something at all, and the reason is the following, is that people were mostly thinking in terms of, let's say, Gross-Pitayevsky, and essentially if you say you have, in this lattice, you have one boson per side, you would say that after all, you have essentially made a modulation which is a uniform one, which is at Q equals zero. And if you imagine a spectrum like this, then the only place, there is no place where you can absorb energy at small frequency at Q equals zero, making a vertical transition. So why should you absorb anything at all? And so people said it's non-linear process, it's because, okay, the experimentalists go with a 20% modulation, which is a serious one. So there were papers in the literature saying this is not linear absorption, this is highly non-linear, and so on and so forth. So people were sort of killing happily each other. Yeah.
I don't remember that. My recollection is that this experiment for a set of 1D needles, it's not just one...
No, there are many 1D needles. Yes.
Okay, right. Yeah. So it's not a large chunk of things continue.
They can, by changing the strength of the optical lattice, they can go from the regime where they get 1D needles. So in the same paper, you will find also the curves for a regime where they put smaller barriers. So they can do the 1D, the quasi 1D, and the 3D.
And this
one is for the 1D. You see it.
Needles,
yeah.
Okay, right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. The other spectrums, look qualitatively similar.
But then I don't understand why the comment of post-Pitayevsky, that wouldn't work. That would be for the whole.
That's exactly what I'm going to say in a second, is that this comment is wrong in various points, but the thing I would like especially to focus would be this. Because I think this is maybe the most interesting regime. that there is. So A, this is wrong to say that this is nonlinear absorption. You can get perfectly linear absorption here. And B, in the Mott insulator, the question is whether this is really a Mott insulator, and the answer is no. Okay, so, and again, here is the list of people with whom we looked at this problem. This was essentially something which was done in two time that I will try to explain. A, first we did what any condensed matter physicist would do, which is to do linear response. And B, because the experimentalists go with a 20% modulation, one had to go beyond linear response. And then we had to kick in some numeric study. And fortunately, Corinna Collat at that point arrived at University of Geneva, and she had developed a method which is this time-dependent density matrix renormalization group, which allows to deal with purely time-dependent system. So essentially, what is the idea? Well, the idea is simple. Is that, again, as I said, you shake the lattice like this. So there are two regimes. The first one is if the modulation is small. So if the lattice is small, then what you do is you say that you have added to the Hamiltonian a term which is the sum over dx, a delta V of x, which is coupled to the density. And so this is modulated with time, so you can treat this in linear response. So what you measure, as usual when you do linear response, the energy absorbed is the imaginary part of the operator to which you couple to. So you're measuring the imaginary part of the density-density correlation function. So you can relate this energy absorbed, so the time derivative of the energy as a function of the frequency, is essentially proportional to essentially the imaginary part of the density correlation function at a vector q, which is a multiple of the modulation of the lattice, and at the frequency, which is the frequency at which you have modulated the lattice. So this is something you can directly do. You don't deal with the trap, you get rid of the trap, and you will deal with the trap when you do the numerics. So here, this is a totally homogeneous situation. And the issue here that we wanted to address was whether there could be some absorption or not some absorption. And the answer is essentially, if you're in 1D, because you're not obeying Gross-Pitayevsky, because you are in a Luttinger liquid and not in a system, and therefore, because the spectrum is something like this, when you look here, you can make absorption, and this absorption here gives you power laws, which are the non-universal power laws that you get in a 1D system. So essentially, this answer, that is this controversy, that in the superfluid you can get absorption even within linear response, and what this will give you is a power law absorption with an exponent here, which is essentially a characteristic of this Schrödinger liquid. Now, if you're in the Mott insulator, we could also work out in linear response what would happen, and then because you open a gap, it means that you get no absorption up to a certain gap, and then you get finite absorption. So at least this was very, I would say, consistent, or this was...
Why don't you see the second...
Okay, this is for small lattice. Now let me move to the strong lattice, because here is for strong lattices. And for strong lattice, this is where one should think, and essentially the main point is that for strong lattice, this is wrong. Or this is unimportant. Why is it unimportant?
Why is it still observation?
No, it's correct. But what is incorrect is the fact that you essentially couple to the density. Because if you look at what happens, for a strong lattice, the hopping element of the particles from one well to the other are essentially controlled by the height of the lattice. So when you modulate this height, what you change in first approximation is the hopping. So the hopping element is now becoming a function of delta V. And this is an exponential effect. So this is by far the dominant effect. So it means that if you have a strong lattice, the perturbation is not essentially the density anymore, but the perturbation is the kinetic energy itself. So what you get is that you get a delta t times sum over I of b dagger, let's say, I plus 1 bi plus d dagger I bi plus 1. So essentially you perturb your Hamiltonian by a term which is the kinetic energy itself.
And things are getting so far. Then in that case, and when you motivate this one, you probably know that in the presence of the laser itself, the Gaussian beam also puts a one harmonic charge.
Yeah.
So therefore, basically, you also doing moderation. Overall weakening values.
Yes. Yes. But here the thing which is modulated is essentially
the potential.
Yeah.
Space and time dimension, which is of the same type.
Yeah,
it's the
same. Yeah. So here again, the trap is not there. We are dealing with an homogeneous system.
Okay, we have a huge beam, the beam size kind of.
Yeah. So I'm just saying here, the main point is that now one should do, even if you do linear response, you should do linear response with this operator, and you see that this operator is nearly a current. It's not exactly the current. So the current would be with a minus sign here. This one is with a plus sign, but this is close enough to measuring the current-current correlation function. So this experiment of shaking the lattice is roughly measuring the optical conductivity. And again, it's not the optical conductivity of the system, but it's close enough because the perturbation here is essentially the kinetic energy. So you can work out the linear response, and then if you work out the linear response, you can do it for the strong lattice, so it's very interesting to do it in the Mott-insulator regime. And there, what you find is that essentially what you should get are peaks, indeed. And you would not be surprised if I tell you that the peaks are at energies which are about U, because the excitations you can make to absorb energy, let's say you're in the Mott insulator regime and you get one particle per site, is essentially to transfer one particle here and make a doubly occupied site on one side of the lattice. This is exactly what this operator is doing, is transferring one particle here, bring it here, you pay the energy U, and then you bring it back, and this is the end of your linear response. So you will measure peaks at energy U, then if you do it twice, then you will get a peak at energy 2U, 3U, 4U, 5U, and so on and so forth. Okay. So this is, yeah.
Which ingredients are you putting in your model? Only this type of modulation?
Yeah. At that stage, for the very large lattice, this can be done in any dimension. This does not rest at all on 1D. So the only ingredient here is that A, U is large, compared to the kinetic energy itself, and B, let's say we have one boson per site just to simplify the system. So in fact, it's not even one boson per site, because here you see that in this paper, we computed it for N0 boson per site. So this is not much more complicated. So this is a perfectly general statement. It's a little bit tricky to compute the shape of the peak, because essentially, even if U is large, what you do is the following. Is you start from a system where...
Jim, can I ask that?
Yeah.
So this thing is coupled to the kinetic energy. Is that just something that the other coupling, the one that couples to the density evolves to, if you look at Feynman wave vector, right?
No, if you look at large lattice modulation. So it depends on whether the lattice modulation is large compared to the kinetic energy of the bosons or small. The trick of the optical lattice is not to increase the interaction, it's to reduce the kinetic energy. This is how you reach strong correlations. The correlations are weak, but you make the kinetic energy even weaker. So you start with bosons which have a certain kinetic energy, which is, let's say, k squared over 2m. And if you put a very small lattice, then this boson will zoom essentially there. Okay? And the repulsion is relatively weak. Now what you do, you make a kind of strong lattice here, which means that then the hopping of the boson from one side to the other is now becoming exponentially small in the height of the lattice. So you can reach the strong correlation because you kill the kinetic energy. And I'm just saying that if now you modulate this lattice, and you start from this limit, essentially the coupling to the density is dominant. But if you start from this limit, the main effect on the parameters, and we can take both into account, but the main effect is essentially the modulation of the height of the lattice.
There's a huge difference between the weak lattice and basically the direction, as you say, is really dominant. You have a shallow lattice, and then if you reach in a deep lattice, then it's really kinetic energy dominant. The interaction is very small.
The interaction is not large, it's never large. You've just made the kinetic energy exponentially small. But then as soon as you touch the lattice, the main change is on the kinetic energy.
What did this happen? What do you do to generate this data?
Oh, the dots are the experimental data. So this one we didn't do anything. We generated the beautiful continuous curve here, which is the result of the essentially linear response to get the peak around you.
Where's the second peak?
Did you
get to you at
1.7? I'll come back to the second peak if you give me one moment. Okay?
Is it around the atomic limit?
This is around the atomic. This one is around the atomic limit. Of course, this one was around the completely opposite limit. But this one is around the atomic limit. We wanted to be, for very large U, to try to see whether we could say something about this peak structure here, which corresponds to extremely large values of U. So here, the only ingredient that comes is U is larger than T, the kinetic energy, and then the difficulty is to deal with the fact that you create a double occupied site and an empty site, and it looks a little bit like the excitonic problem. So you have one band which has been full, you promote one guy to the band of doubly occupied site, and you leave a hole behind. And the difficulty is to deal with the motion of these two guys that can go everywhere, so they look like free particles, except they cannot go on the same site, because if they go on the same site, they recombine, and that's the end. So you have to deal with their motion with this exclusion principle between the two. But okay, you can do that. This is resumming some diagrams. And at the end of the day, you get this type of expression here, which gives you the shape of the P. Yeah?
Excuse me, where are you talking now? For two-dimensional, or where did you draw it?
This is for 1D. You can do the calculation, essentially determine, okay, the shape of the peak gives some complicated integral in more than 1D, but essentially you can do it in any dimension. And essentially it will give you a peak at U in any dimension, and the precise shape will depend on the dimension. The fact that the width here is about the kinetic energy is there essentially in any dimension, so that's generic. Okay? Is it okay? Okay, so... And you see that it even fits the data not too badly. Now, as you pointed out, there is not only a peak at U, but there is another structure here, and we don't see any. In linear response A, it's complicated to...
Can you show the other one?
This one?
Yeah. I see. So okay. So we can...
And let me tell you why. A, in linear response, is extremely complicated to compute the peak at 2U, because it would mean that one makes two of these excitations. But you can estimate the order of magnitude of the matrix element. It's extremely small. So you don't see, you shouldn't see any.
Oh, because you say you do...
Because it's something like T over U to the power 4 or whatever. I mean, it's extremely small. So you shouldn't see any, and you do see one in an experiment. So why? So the natural thing would be to say, okay, these guys, they went to 20% modulation, so this has something to do with nonlinear effects and so on and so forth. So in order to go beyond linear response, as I said, with Corinna Collat and the group in Haren, we tried to use this adaptive time-dependent DMRG, which is a very nice method, because it's a method that allows you to deal with an out-of-equilibrium system. So you really take a system, you put something which is time-dependent in the Hamiltonian, and you can do the numerics on it. If you think of it, this is the only method that exists that allows you to do this for an interacting system. Because if you do Monte Carlo, you're in imaginary time, and you cannot do real-time dynamics.
Yes, so this is... Don't you at some point you can cast things in terms of spectral functions? If I have spectral functions, wouldn't I see if there is peaks?
No, it's not exactly the spectral function. As I said, if any, this object is very, very close to the current correlation function. I'm not saying it is. It's not exactly that, because this is not the current.
But
so if any, The way you can write a diagram for this is to say you come with an energy omega, this creates a particle, this creates a hole, and these two particles will propagate. This creates a doubly occupied site, and this creates a hole, and these two guys will propagate, but because they have this exclusion principle, you have to put interaction in such a way that they repel, they don't want to be on the same site.
This whole thing is you didn't see a second peak.
No, there is a second peak.
The point I'm making is that its weight is extremely, extremely small. So there is a second peak at 2U because you can make two of these excitations. I'm just saying that the weight is much, 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 much smaller than the one that is observed in the experiment. So the second peak which is observed in the experiment is not the one that you would get for a commensurate Mott insulator.
Well, it wasn't that much about this existence. Actually, the question whether it's 1.7 or 2, that's a mystery, that why it's not 2.
I will tell you why it's not 2.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, so you think it's not if that could just have a large delta T, so then it's not suppressed by delta T?
I'm saying essentially this peak at 2U, because it involves two excitations, would have a matrix element. Now I've forgotten the precise power, but of the order of T over U to the power 4 or whatever. Okay. So it should be 1,000 smaller or something like this than the peak you see.
Six or eight.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nuts power. I mean, it's completely nuts. So essentially, if you were plotting, forgetting about the details, but we're plotting the two peaks, this one is totally unobservable.
Can you really make that argument even when delta T is large? When the amplitude of a bunch of the probe is large?
Yeah, I can make it from the numerics, because from the numerics we can deal with the 20% modulation. We can deal with 100% modulation. So here, let me show you the curve. So these are typical curves that you see of the variation of the energy as a function of time, and you see clearly the energy growing and then saturating because the system at some point cannot absorb any more energy. So if you are in the linear regime here, you can use linear response to fit the slope. And you can even make, for small modulation, a comparison between the linear response calculation that we did and the numerics. And you see that the two fit absolutely beautifully. And so this gives a serious confidence on the fact that the numerics is correctly working and that there is no mistake in the linear response. I emphasize this because this was the first time that this was used to really study an out-of-equilibrium problem. Corinna and Uli and collaborator did it to study problems with wrong initial conditions. So you take a static Hamiltonian, you start from a wrong condition, and then you see how it evolves with time. But here, the Hamiltonian is time-dependent. So this was one order of magnitude more difficult, but you see that it works beautifully to tackle this problem. So this is allowing us now to just go to 20% modulation, which corresponds to the experiment, and still you will not see the second peak. And essentially, you have to do some twist if you want to see the second peak. And here it is, very beautiful, even larger than the first peak. And how did you get it? 38 sites, a length of 32. So we put more atoms than one atom per site. And the reason is the following, that there are two processes that allows you to get a peak at 2U. The first one is the one I described before, which is that you get one atom per site, and essentially you make two of these excitations. Okay? So this gives 2U, and the matrix element of this is ridiculously small. But there is another one if you are in an incommensurate system. So if you have more than one atom per site at some places, you can take one of these guys and put three of them on the same site. And this is also an excitation which is of order 2U. And what this directly shows you is that this is vastly dominant. Even if you have a couple of percent doping, let's say 10% doping, this is vastly dominant in terms of the response that you will get, and it gives you a very nice peak at essentially 2U. And now if you look at what happens when you put numbers which correspond to the experiment, you see that the peak at U broadens, the peak at 2U moves, and the position that it assumes is in very good agreement with what is observed in experiment. So here you see we reduce the recoil energy, we reduce the modulation of the lattice to go back in phase with what Tillman experiment was about. So the point, the claim that we make is that we can explain the experiment provided we assume that this is not a filling of one boson per site, but this is a filling of, let's say, 1.2 or whatever boson per site. And there, the position of the peak even agree quite nicely with the experiment. Now, you could say this is a simulation that was done on an homogeneous system, taking incommensurability explicitly into account. Now, the incommensurability is coming from the trap, so what about the trap and whatever? Here is a simulation that we did comparing a homogeneous system and a system in presence of the trap. Doing the MRG with the trap is considerably more difficult. But okay, it can be done. And
how big the system you do?
This one, that's a good question. I don't remember, about 30 sites or so. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you give more details on this?
You mean on the numerical MRG procedure?
Huh?
Yes, I can give you more details for that. It would take 1 hour. okay, so the idea is the following. I refer you to the papers that Corinna and Uli Schulweg published on the subject. But the idea is the following, is that you essentially look at the time evolution of your system. And this is what normally gives you your Schrödinger equation. And then essentially, when you use the DMRG procedure, what you get is a bunch of, let's say, important states.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say low-lying energy states, but it's not really true. It's a bunch of states that are important to describe essentially the physics of your system. Now, using these states, using this restricted Hilbert space, then you can construct the dynamics of the system. And the thing you have to do is that each step, essentially, you have to reconstruct this basis and reconstruct the Hamiltonian you use for the dynamics.
No, I was asking for the trap.
No, so here you just add the trap to the Hamiltonian and you redo the DMRG calculation. The difficulty here is a question of convergence, meaning that when you have the trap, there are many, I would call it metastable states, and it's much more difficult to converge than when you are in the homogeneous system.
Also, if you have an area with a superfluid in between, it is gapless, and
yeah,
it's a big problem.
But again, the system is a superfluid, in a sense that you see that because of the trap, it has a region here which is non-commensurate, essentially. So this I would not call completely a Mott insulator. It has a region here which is a superfluid, and this is because of this superfluid region that you get the second peak. If you add a Mott insulator, you would essentially lose the second peak. So the claim is that this method is in fact quite nice, because contrarily to what was sort of anticipated, this is not really a Mott insulator. The filling is not exactly correct, or the trap, if you want, makes the filling not exactly correct. But the main point is that deciding whether you had a superfluid from looking at the low energy here part of the spectrum would have been extremely difficult, even in 1D where you can distinguish, simply because experimentally it's very difficult to make the measurement here. But if you look at the peak at 2U, you can, from the peak at 2U, by looking at the weight you get at 2U, you can decide whether the system is really nicely commensurate or not nicely commensurate. And the claim is that if you have a peak at 2U, it's not nicely commensurate. So this is a technique that A can tell you how much doping you get.
Whether you have a chunk of the superfluid.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's superfluid.
Yeah, it's superfluid.
How can you distinguish?
So it's not a Mott insulator here. It's a superfluid.
All superfluid.
All superfluid. Just the peak that broaden and merge and give you a broaden.
How can you distinguish whether your incommensurability is not a temperature effect that you have?
Yes, so we tried to see whether the number of defects could be, okay, A, this is zero temperature calculations, so here it's clearly not the temperature effect. Now, in the experiments, you're right, there are probably both that contributes, the temperature and the effect from the trap. If one tries to put number for the temperature, it seems to give way too small a number for the incommensurability we need. Here it's clear that it's only, an incommensurability that comes from the trap or the incommensurability we put back.
Temperature and the Mott insulator for the experiment?
Well,
I mean, it's adiabatic crossing, so it's not quite clear how much.
No, it's not clear. I agree with you. That's why the honest answer with you would be to say they should redo the experiment, try to estimate the temperature, try to check these effects. But, okay, taking numbers that seem reasonable compared to, you know, where one can estimate the temperature, it seems that the number of defects is much small, it's too small to be simply due to a pure thermal effect above the MOT insulator. So the best bet we have would be that, again, the trap is, or simply the filling of the tube is not good enough to put you exactly on the MOT insulator regime. But it's clearly something that would need more.
Why do the atoms over integer filling have more effect on this peak around 2U than on the absorption at low frequency?
No, it's not that they have more effect. Is they have also effect for the absorption at low frequency, except that you see here in the numerics it's even difficult to see. It's just that experimentally they have a very hard time measuring the absorption at low frequency.
So
simply because it takes ages.
Why is it that we see the peak easily and we don't see the absorption at low frequency?
Because again, how would you see that you get a superfluid, you're in a MOT insulator.
So, if you're not
okay. Now, if you're in a superfluid, now if you're in a MOT insulator, then you do not expect to see anything. Now, if you're in a superfluid, then what you will see is some absorption at low frequency, and if you're in 1D, this absorption will have a tail going down as a power law. And if the peak is high enough here, it will be in the noise level. You will not see anything here. So you're perfectly right that if I'm in a superfluid regime in 1D, I should see this thing here ending up with a tail which will end up as a power law here.
But is it a power law tail even if you're in the deep trap regime where you have this perturbation that couples?
That's a good question. It's a power law tail if you're in the density regime. If you're in the deep trap, it might just be a peak at zero frequency. I have to check. I don't remember this. So, if this is it, you will never see it, essentially. Because, you know, peak at zero frequency does not exist experimentally. Okay, unless you do measurement of Josephson effects or things like this. But you see that here, at least for frequencies which reach, let's say, one half or one quarter of U, there is no trace of difference between superfluids.
I'm wondering why.
I think you're okay. I have to put my thought in order on that. But I think in the deep regime, it's quite possible that the only effect is just the peak at zero frequency. Okay. Before everybody is exhausted, let me just tell you something on this method for fermions and why we think it could be useful in two ways. One is that you can do the same thing for fermions, except that here you cannot measure the absorbed energy. You cannot measure the absorbed energy because there is no way of making the good time of flight experiment. So what we propose is instead of measuring the absorbed energy, you measure the number of doubly occupied sites by the molecule formation that was mentioned before. And if you do this, you see that there is a very good correlation between the absorption of energy here and the change of the number of doubly occupied sites. This is plotted in opposite signs just to show. Usually you do a Feshbach resonance, bring the repulsion to attraction very fast, and then count the number of molecules that are formed. That's something we did not mention in the probes. But essentially, if you say you have here a doubly occupied site, here singly, here doubly, and suddenly you change U from positive to U negative very fast, much faster than the time for the particle to hop from one side to the other, you will just freeze the sites that are doubly occupied at the time when you do the change of sign of the attraction. So this is a way, in principle, to count the number of doubly occupied sites in the system. And this is also something I discussed a little bit with Tillman last week. He seemed to have doubts on whether this was really measuring the number of doubly occupied sites, so we can debate on this. But for the moment, let me assume that there is a method to measure the number of doubly occupied sites.
This technique has not been demonstrated
experimentally. No, they have done, in the group of Tillman, they have done the change of sign in the and formed the molecules. What they are having doubts, if I understood well what Tillman was telling me, is whether this is really giving access to the number of doubly occupied sites before you do the ramping or not. And okay, I would have to discuss more with him to know whether his concerns are serious or whether. But this has been done. Okay. In any case, just to show here that there is a very good correlation between the energy which is absorbed that normally you would measure by doing.
What he does, when he fights the situation, he starts with a positive view on the side and then swap and then move to the other side. But what he sees is that he starts with band insulator, two per side, and then when you go across the threshold resonance, you see a population of several higher bands, and then he can map out those populations. Now on the contrary, you want to start with maybe one side, and then you want to go over some place and then see how many two that you get. Right? Yeah. This is a very different.
Yeah. So I want to start, let's say, with one particle per side, and then okay, either by kinetic energy or by thermal activation or whatever, there will be some sites that will get doubly occupied, some sites that will get empty and whatever. And if at some point here you ramp up the thing to make an attraction, only the doubly occupied site can form molecules, provided again you ramp the interaction faster than the time it takes to jump from one side to the other.
Okay. May I suggest, that the very effective method is actually the method that the MIT has done, I think, about 6 or 8 months ago. What they do is what it darkens when a comet clock. Basically, you just look at the this atom go to the excited state, and then depending on that interaction shift, and you get two particles per second shift, and so that's a good counting total number of
ramping something. So you say it's a better, in fact, to measure the resonance or the energy which will be modified by the presence of the. Now that's a very good point. So the point is that again with fermions you cannot use the time of flight experiment to get the energy. Okay, so just to make a long story short, there is a very good correlation between the absorbed energy and the change in the number of doubly occupied sites. So one can really use the number of doubly occupied sites to do the shaking. For the fermions, there is no peak at 2U. And so essentially the peak at U, the thing we checked is A, that the peak, the position of the peak at U is extremely robust. You can change a lot of parameters, it's always sitting at U with a very good accuracy, so it can be a measure of U itself, of the repulsion itself, which for fermions is not that easy to determine. But more importantly, and let me finish on that, the thing which is interesting is that if you measure the weight of this peak at U, then one can see that it's directly correlated. So here is the weight that one can get out of various temperatures and for various systems, and it's directly correlated to the spin-spin correlation function, the nearest neighbor spin-spin correlation function. So if you compute the spin-spin correlation function, the antiferromagnetic correlation function, it's directly related to this peak. And you can understand it by saying that the operator here that creates the transition is something that lets the fermion jump from one side to the neighboring side. And it can only jump if the fermion on the neighboring side is of opposite spin. If not, the Pauli principle blocks you. So essentially, when this peak has a lot of spectral weight, it means that you get a maximum of antiferromagnetic correlation. So what we propose is that one could use also the shaking of the lattice as a probe to test for the antiferromagnetic correlation, or at least get an idea where in the phase diagram the antiferromagnetic correlations are maximum. Yeah, sorry.
But there is a big difference between. Is it right to say that this is not the same as the long-range correlation?
No, it's short-range correlation. You're absolutely right. This is the fact that two neighbors will have antiferromagnetic correlation. So it doesn't tell you at all that the system wants to order on very, very long distances. But this will never be accessed by this method because, again, the operator creating the perturbation is something which is extremely local perturbation, so you need something else to be able to address the long-range correlations. Okay, so that's all what I wanted to say for the shaking. I think I've taken more than your time. I just would like to finish by a little advertisement. I will not say anything. It's just that we propose a method that would maybe answer your question, which is how to address. So this is done in collaboration with Corinna Collat and Michael Curl, who is now in Cambridge, was in the group of Tillman, who is now in Cambridge. And they were really the primum mobile in this proposal. But the idea is that all the problems that these probes have is that they are global probes. And so they are extremely sensitive to the inhomogeneities, to the trapping potential, and so on. So what we wanted to try to have is something which can probe really local points in the system. And in condensed matter, there is something which is very nice, which is the STM. So you bring a tip, and then you make electron tunnel at a given point in the system, and what we have is a proposal on how to make an STM for cold atoms, and essentially using an ion that would be trapped and that one can use to form molecules with the rest of the system. So we think that maybe this probe could be used in two ways. A, to answer the question you had, which is if one probes here at different sites, one can decide whether there is good long-range antiferromagnetism order or not. And what I think is also interesting is that with this probe, one can make local tunneling by forming a molecule and then releasing the atom inside the system. And so one can probe the local density of state. So this is something which, as the STM, can be used for imaging and can be used also for spectroscopy by probing the local density of state. So this is a theoretical probe for the moment. At least there was one experimentalist that were willing to put his head on the paper. So I hope he believes that it can be realized. But I think that if it works, it will be something that should be extremely useful because it can give a local access, which means that even in presence of the confining potential, one can find a region where the phase is homogeneous enough to probe for correlation. Okay.
I can see every color could work only at the surface, no?
Yeah, exactly. I say exactly, at least that's... It's not completely true, because the only thing you need is to have an ion that you can bring close enough to a site so that you can make the molecule formation. So naively for me, you will do it on the surface. Yeah. Now, I don't know whether one can embed really an ion inside the system to do it. Certainly it will be much, much simpler on the surface.
So what do you propose to hold the ion? Is it a laser or is it a metal trap that you...
Sorry?
What the ion?
What keeps the ion? The pole trap.
This well, what do you use for this well?
Pole trap. Pole? Powell? I don't know. Pole trap.
Or?
Just an ion.
That's it.
Okay, so I stop here, and I think, but I think...
How does it affect the lattice? The question is, does it affect the lattice?
I think what I should do... okay, so I think this is the probe on which we worked, and I think, as I said, this shaking of the lattice is one spectroscopy probe. This one, which again, the shaking exists, the other one doesn't, but we hope it will be realized in the future. I think it's exciting to be able to get spectroscopy because ultimately this is what will give information on the nature of the strongly correlated phases in this system. And again, I think to finish the discussion, the best is to have this list of probes and see whether there are things we would like to add to this list or whether there are things we feel is missing on this list to probe the various cold atoms.
On this list, I think it has many ways of measuring spin structure, which
that would be nice. As I said, I've not seen papers really reporting on spin orders, but no, that's my failure, not the failure of literature necessarily. Okay, so I think it's better to stop here, and thank you for your attention.